The following podcast is part of a certified educational activity titled Screening and Early Intervention as the Keys to Success in Lung Cancer, a Practical Approach to Implementing Lung Cancer Screening for High-Risk Individuals. Access the entire activity and complete the post-test at peerview.com/PJP860. Downloadable slides and practice aids are also available.
Hello, and welcome to this activity titled Screening and Early Intervention as the Keys to Success in Lung Cancer, a Practical Approach to Implementing Lung Cancer Screening for High-Risk Individuals. My name is Leisha Sequist. I'm a medical oncologist and director of the Cancer Early Detection and Diagnostics Program at Mass General Hospital and the Landry Family Professor of Medicine at Harvard Medical School. I'd like you to meet my co-faculty member, Dr. Nadasinghe.
Hi, everyone. My name is Pat Nadasinghe. I serve as chair of the Division of Pulmonary Diseases and Critical Care Medicine, as well as the Linda Grandis Blatt Chair of Lung Cancer Research and Associate Director of the Wright Center for Clinical and Translational Research at Virginia Commonwealth University in Richmond, Virginia. Before we get started, we'd like to first acknowledge and thank the Longevity Foundation, which is partnering with us in this educational activity and has prepared a useful supplemental resource compendium on lung cancer screening. There are several goals for today, four, in fact, and our goals are really to improve your ability to identify patients at high risk for lung cancer and really thinking about who should be screened for lung cancer. Secondly, we really want to get you to understand the clinician-patient-related barriers that can lead to suboptimal screening rates. Third, we'd like to improve your skills in implementing lung cancer screening and determining how to best do follow-up in the real-world practice. And then lastly, we'd like to introduce you to some of the current and emerging therapies that might improve outcomes for patients with lung cancer who've been diagnosed in earlier stages of disease. Okay, so right now in Module 2, this is entitled Implementing Lung Cancer Screening Barriers and Success Strategies. So in this module, what we'd like to do is really review with you some of the challenges in implementing lung cancer screening and provide you with some practical strategies for overcoming some of these challenges so that you can improve rates of lung cancer screening in your particular practice. So the first thing to mention is that even though the National Lung Screening Trial has been really in practice for several years now, the uptake of lung cancer screening has been disappointingly low. In fact, according to the State of Lung Cancer Report from the American Lung Association, only about 4.5% of those at high risk have actually been screened. And those are those are numbers that really have to improve. When we look across the United States, there are some states that appear to be doing a bit better. For example, Massachusetts is up to about 12%, and California is less than 1% in terms of eligible individuals actually being screened for lung cancer. So we still have a tremendous amount of work to do. So the question that really comes to mind is, what are the challenges? Why can't we really screen more people who are eligible for lung cancer? In terms of the challenges to lung cancer screening, there are many. And what we've outlined for you here are some of the patient-related challenges or barriers and provider-related. On the patient-related side, one that comes up quite often has to do with access to a screening center. It's well known that we have populations of individuals who are most impacted by lung cancer yet do not have access to screening centers within at least a drivable distance. There's also the concern about fear. Many patients will express to us that they just have fear of being screened. In fact, many of my patients will say, well, if I get screened, does that mean I will have lung cancer? There's a general lack of knowledge out in our communities about lung cancer screening, the ease with which it can be done, and the fact that lung cancer screening rarely results in a diagnosis of lung cancer. There are concerns about radiation risk. And then, of course, adherence continues to be an issue in many programs. In terms of provider-related barriers or challenges, I think there's still a misunderstanding of guidelines. When we've seen many studies that have been done really assessing understanding of guidelines, it's clear that there's still work that needs to be done. In fact, in many studies, approximately 50 to perhaps 60% of practitioners out in the community are actually very familiar with the guidelines for lung cancer screening. Lack of time. I think we need to be very cognizant of the fact that providers in their practice are managing patients with many comorbid illnesses, and they have to prioritize. And often it's difficult for them to find the time to have that shared decision-making discussion to, to discuss the results of a CT scan in a comprehensive manner. There's also the lack of electronic health record notifications. This is something that I think plagues many large medical centers, is how do we create a seamless notification system within the EMR so that it becomes much easier to recognize who should be screened. And then lastly, there's the issue of management of incidental findings. It's not that infrequent that I have providers come to me and say, well, what do I do with all these findings? And I don't have necessarily a workflow or an algorithm for how to manage all of these incidental findings that might come up. You know, Dr. Sequist, what in your experience are some of the challenges that that you've seen in just getting our lung cancer screening rates up to a much more reasonable number across the country and in your practice?
Yeah, these are some of the key ones which you have outlined. I mean, I think our colleagues who are ordering the scans are concerned about how they'll figure out exactly who's eligible. The pack years of smoking history is poorly captured in the medical record, and they're also worried what they'll do with findings. And we know that a lot of pulmonary nodules that are cancer can be picked up. And so, you know, you need to be able to have those resources to help you figure out which are the ones that are worrisome. And that's why pulmonary nodule clinics can be so helpful. I think as more of our centers and established pulmonary nodule clinics, it's really helping the primary care providers feel more comfortable because there's someone to guide them through the process if something is found on screening.
So this is an image that basically provides you with really a snapshot of across the country of mortality rates, areas where there are high mortality rates for lung cancer. And then we have superimposed the distances from lung cancer screening centers. And in blue, what you have are 30-minute drive time. And in yellow, which you can see a fair amount of yellow, is 60-minute drive time. And I think the take-home message here is that we just need to do better. We need to do better in terms of really, really ensuring that those individuals who are in those high mortality rate regions actually have access to screening. And I think this slide really gives you sort of that overall image of this issue of there being high risk, high mortality regions, yet you have on this slide regions where the mortality is high, but there's no access really to a screening center within a 60-minute drive. But there is some good news. And this is an example of one particular initiative that is starting to gain some momentum across the country. And this is concept of mobile lung cancer screening. There are several programs that are popping up really all over the country that are really trying to address that one issue that I was just mentioning. This is an example of a study of about 200 patients. And interestingly, this was a study that was done in New York City. It was done in Brooklyn. And essentially, the team basically set up a CT scanner. They brought it in on a tractor trailer. They placed it in a very busy region within New York City, one that was easily accessible by multiple subway lines. And they essentially opened their doors and provided free screening to any individual who expressed interest within a certain age. These individuals were 50 years or older in age. And what came of this was actually very, very interesting. And that is, in this particular study, they were able to screen a large number of patients, 200 patients. They identified about two lung cancers in those individuals. And they determined that in this relatively small study that this could be a successful model. But there are several things to consider. One is that the educational program that you have in place has to be very, very strong when it comes to mobile lung cancer screening. Without a doubt, community engagement is key. When you're deciding to perhaps set up this type of program within a community, particularly if there are communities that are not very aware about lung cancer screening and don't have much health literacy in that space, it's going to be really important for you to ensure that you're engaging the community. Third, downstream navigation of positive incidental findings are absolutely essential. I know that when we've discussed in our own center the concept of mobile lung cancer screening, this tends to come up quite frequently. And that is, well, what do you do with the positive findings? What do you do with the incidental findings? Do you have a safety net in place so that any abnormality can be addressed and can be managed in the long run? And then importantly, it's accessible locations. I think this particular initiative was successful because it was in fact located in a region that was walkable and easily accessible. Now, another question that comes up and a challenge has to do with radiation risk. This is something that I get asked quite often by both patients as well as practitioners. That is, what's my lifetime risk for in terms of radiation causing another cancer? That's not an infrequent question that I get asked. This is a particular study that was published just a couple of years ago, doing modeling and looking at what is really the risk, depending on the age at which you start screening, over a period of time from 50 all the way to 75. And really the take-home message is the following. The overall radiation lifetime attributable risk is quite low, actually, for women. It's about 0.25%. And for men, it's 0.1%. So we're really talking about, you know, 1 in 1,000. And when you take into consideration the fact that there's mortality benefit from actual lung cancer screening, and you think about what's the benefit to risk ratio, it's actually quite high. It's 10 for women, and it's 25 for men. So at the end of the day, when you present this to your patients, most of the time what I found is they realize that, yes, the benefits really, really do outweigh the risks significantly when it comes to being screened for lung cancer. You know, another approach is the concept really of patient navigation, incorporating a patient navigator in your lung cancer screening program. This is a randomized study, not necessarily a large number of patients, but a randomized study where some individuals basically underwent lung cancer screening, but they had a patient navigator. And in this particular case, which is really important, this was a lay navigator. This was an individual that had been basically recruited from the community, had been educated on lung cancer screening, which is, I think, very important when we think about community engagement. And what we found is that in this particular study, that the uptake of lung cancer screening was much, much higher. You could see in the graph there that you had lung cancer screening CTs in the intervention arm or the patient navigation arm about 20, almost 24% versus about 9% in the control. So this is really suggests that just having a navigator, someone who is even maybe part of the community, that's a lay navigator, can have tremendous impact on your uptake of lung cancer screening. These individuals can be really, really helpful in patient eligibility, introduction of shared decision-making, smoking cessation, and importantly, as I was mentioning earlier, proper follow-up. Now, Dr. Sequist, in your own programs, in your institution, have you found that having navigators can really sort of have an impact on the uptake of lung cancer screening?
Definitely, especially in some portions of our population that we serve. For example, there's a neighborhood or a region that has a lot of patients with Spanish as their primary language, and having a Spanish-speaking peer navigator has helped that community significantly in getting people to be able to successfully go to their screening scan.
So as I mentioned earlier, incidental findings is also one big concern. It's a concern for patients. It's also a concern for their physicians. What do we do with all of the incidental findings? Are there really any guidelines on how to really manage those incidental findings that do, in fact, come up? I think what's important to note is that the majority of incidental findings are not necessarily actionable, but there still needs to be some type of plan in how you're going to address an actionable incidental finding. What we're showing you here are basically a quick reference guide from the American College of Radiology on just how to go about managing specific common incidental findings that come up. In this particular study, what they've done is taken that reference guide and then looked in various settings to determine really what is the feedback on using this type of guideline or reference guide. And what's really important to note is that among incidental findings, really most are going to be coronary artery calcium scores. Then about 20% are going to be some type of abnormality in the lung, and then an extra pulmonary abnormality about 15% of the time. But importantly, most navigators really found that having this type of reference guide is really, really, really helpful in terms of their everyday practice and in terms of how to manage these types of incidental findings. So, you know, one suggestion we would make is as you are expanding your lung cancer screening program or maybe initiating a lung cancer screening program, it's important to have some generalized shared mental model on how you're going to manage a lot of these incidental findings, because they will come up. They will cause consternation among your patients and even among your physicians. So having some type of clear guidelines, I think, are really important. So Dr. Sequist, did you want to talk a little bit about another, exciting finding from lung cancer screening.
Yeah, there's a lot of barriers with lung cancer screening, but I think it's also important to illustrate some of the successes. Navigation is certainly a success. Having lung nodule programs to help manage findings is a success. I think one thing that some physicians were concerned about was whether we would be overdiagnosing a lot of patients by doing lung cancer screening, you know, similar to what we found when PSA screening was implemented for prostate cancer screening. We were diagnosing a lot of men with prostate cancer who were never going to have a health effect or certainly die from that cancer. We are not seeing that that occur in lung cancer so far. And here's some data over a 4 to 5 year period of real world screening across four big health systems. This was published by Anil Bachani from UPenn just last year. And what you can see here is if you look at the cancers that were diagnosed in this population that had been screened, you see a couple of important points which are in the boxes. So one, on the left, the overall lung cancer rate did not change. The per capita rate did not change across this large population. So that suggests that we're not just diagnosing a lot of extra people with lung cancer by doing lung cancer screening. We're still finding the same number of lung cancers. What has changed is what stage we're finding them at. So then in the second box in the middle, you can see that the population per capita that was diagnosed with stage one lung cancer went up from 37 up to 54. But the per capita rate of stage four diagnoses went down. So we essentially took some of those patients who were going to ultimately present when they had symptomatic stage four disease. We were able to detect them early at stage one disease. So that stage shift is a very positive thing to find. And at the same time, we did not see a rise in the total number of lung cancers, which would suggest overdiagnosis. Really encouraging. And then similarly, the American Cancer Society puts out annual facts and figures every year. And in 2022, they focused a special section of their report on lung cancer. And they also noted that since the first USPSTF screening guidelines were implemented in 2013, up until the time of their data cut, they also saw stage shift happen across the U.S. And look at that fall in the number of distant or stage four patients and the rise in the green line with local or stage one and two lung cancer. And this is keeping in mind that we're screening less 5% of those eligible. Imagine what kind of stage shift we would see if we were actually screening at scale. So some hints of good news as we start to implement lung cancer.
So what are some keys to effective lung cancer screening uptake? We've talked about several of the barriers or challenges, but there are a few, I think, take-home messages here. One is really ensuring adequate knowledge regarding lung cancer screening, and time for providers to incorporate shared decision-making in their practice. The reality is when we think about lung cancer screening compared to, for example, to screening for colon cancer or breast cancer for that matter, we're still a relatively young field, the field of lung cancer screening. So we still have a fair amount of work to do to just ensure that there is, in fact, universal understanding and universal knowledge when it comes to lung cancer screening. So I think that's really an important point that we should all be striving to ensure that our communities as well as our colleagues understand everything there is to understand about lung cancer screening. Secondly, as we mentioned earlier, the importance of engaging the community in dissemination of lung cancer screening awareness. We showed earlier that there are communities that are disproportionately impacted by lung cancer, yet they don't have access to screening centers, or perhaps they do have access, but there are issues of trust and misconceptions. So this is where really focusing in on engaging the community and taking various steps to ensure that our partners understand and the partners of the community understand the importance of lung cancer screening and how it may save a life. Third is really the importance of integration of navigation, lay navigators, even when you're thinking about how to reach certain communities. And they can really be valuable in identification of eligible patients, having those initial conversations to introduce the concept of screening or shared decision-making, maybe smoking cessation, and also can help with follow-up. The fourth is just the use of shared decision-making tools. There are many that are out there, many of which can be very, very, I think, helpful in getting patients to truly understand the risk benefit of lung cancer screening. And then lastly, we would really encourage all providers to think about personalizing that shared decision-making. And the reality is one size does not fit all. And their populations are responsive to different types of approaches when it comes to shared decision-making. So really take that into consideration when you're thinking about having that discussion about lung cancer screening. There are several resources that are out there. We just want to bring to your attention, Longevity has several resources on lung cancer screening that are both geared towards patients as well as clinicians. We would encourage you to access these particular resources and use them in your own practices.
So here in Module 3, we're going to talk about future directions in lung cancer screening. And we'll talk about some of the new directions and strategies that are showing promise in improving how we get patients, how we select patients for lung cancer screening. And maybe to start off, before we get to the future, we can talk about the present and what we do these days. I'm going to ask Dr. Nada Singham, who refers more patients for lung cancer screening than I do as an oncologist, about some of the tools that he uses and some of the data behind those tools.
Great, thank you. So, one thing that's really important that we've been talking about so far is this concept of risk and what constitutes risk. And here what you're seeing is that risk really does go beyond age and smoking history. This is an important study that was published now 10 years ago, really looking at whether there are in fact some additional demographic risk factors that should be taken into consideration, and how taking these additional factors into consideration and then comparing that risk to the risk that you would get just from age and smoking as outlined by the LNST, how do they actually compare? And what's interesting is that when you take into consideration some of these other factors, such as being Black or African American, such as having a personal history of cancer, a family history of lung cancer, having COPD, what you find is that when you develop a risk score, taking into consideration these other factors, and you compare it to the NLST, what you find is that this performs much better in terms of really identifying those individuals who will, in fact, go on to have lung cancer. So what I like to do now in my own practice is I start to take these into consideration when I see every patient who's being screened for lung cancer. So I do, in fact, look beyond age and smoking history. And if I determine based on these factors that a person is in fact high risk for lung cancer, that's when that real personalized conversation starts to take place. And we start to think about, well, maybe even though the age and smoking history don't exactly fit LST, there are other factors that we should take into consideration. And then that then shapes the conversation moving forward. This is another way to look at it. And I like to say that risk determines benefit. One of the early concerns about lung cancer screening was that, well, maybe we need to screen so many people to really see benefit in a single individual. And that comes up in many screening studies. This is a study by Dr. Kowalczyk and colleagues, again, about 10 years ago, where they, instead of looking at the risk of getting lung cancer, they looked at the five-year risk of lung cancer death. And taking into consideration several of the factors, many of which overlap with the factors I showed in the last slide, age, being female, race, BMI, emphysema, first-degree relative lung cancer, they basically created a risk score and then stratified individuals who were in the NLST using these additional variables into quintiles from low risk, 0.15 to 0.55% five-year risk of lung cancer death, all the way to greater than 2%. And what you can see as you move from left to right on this particular table, you see false positives per prevented lung cancer death. False positivity is something we always have concerns about in any screening test. And you can see how that number drops dramatically from 1,648 all the way down to 65. Simply by taking into consideration these other factors and creating a risk score and determining who is really at the highest risk of getting lung cancer. And then importantly, we talk about NNS, or number needed to screen. How many folks do I really need to screen to show benefit in a single individual? And what you can see is as you go from low risk, 0.15 to 0.55% five-year risk, all the way to greater than 2%, you can see how that number drops dramatically from 5,276 down to 161. So it's the reason why we like to say that determining risk is evolving, and ultimately we want to be able to screen those individuals who are at highest risk, and then probably not necessarily screen those individuals who are at lowest risk and may not actually benefit from lung cancer screening.
I think this kind of work is really important. But I think that our understanding of the risk factors is still incomplete. For example, air pollution, we don't exactly know how the best way to measure an individual's lifetime exposure to air pollution is best accomplished. And so one of the things, and my group has been researching along with computer scientists at MIT, is whether we can bring artificial intelligence into this equation and maybe get a risk assessment without necessarily knowing all the factors to plug into the model. One way to do that is by looking at the images. The chest CT has so much fine detail and wealth of data that's there, in addition to just, you know, is there a lung nodule or is there a cancer visible at the current time? It shows the underlying biological consequences of all of the different factors that have, you know, that someone has breathed in or that is in their genetics. So it not only shows the exposures, but importantly, what the host reaction to those exposures has been, at least in the way that the architecture of the lung exists in the adult patient. So we designed this algorithm called Sybil, which is basically a machine learning algorithm that has been trained on thousands of scans, actually from the NLST trial, to recognize patterns that predict future lung cancer. This is a really different concept because we usually use radiology to tell what's happening in a patient today. You know, they got in a car accident, their arm hurts. We use radiology to see, is the bone broken? But we don't always use radiology to predict what might happen 1, 3, 5 years in the future. This is an algorithm which takes a low-dose CT from today and does just that. It predicts whether the patient may develop lung cancer in the future, regardless of whether there's any nodules currently. It's nice in that there's no clinical data needed. You don't have to put in the age, sex, smoking history, education, family history, any of those types of variables. And you don't have to annotate the images by circling any sort of region of interest. It just automatically reads the images. And through this large language model, then produces a six-year future risk. And we validated this model on a number of different, three different validation cohorts. One was cases from the NLST that were not part of the training, and that's shown in panel A. Panel B shows an NGH cohort of about 9,000 scans, screen patients. And then panels A and B of note are very similar because they're both U.S. patients and they're both patients with a heavy tobacco history. Panel C is really different. These are 12,000 scans from a screening program in Taiwan, where they do population-based screening. Because the rates of lung cancer are so high in East Asia and affect both people who have used tobacco and people who have never used tobacco, they've actually adopted a population-wide screening strategy. So these are patients over the age of 55 of any tobacco exposure history. And you can see that Sybil was able to very accurately predict the future occurrence of lung cancer from a single LPCT across these populations. It can be hard to look at a curve like that and sort of think clinically, what does that mean? How would I react as a provider on a Sybil score? And so this is an example, a select example of how it potentially could impact clinical care. So what you see on the right-hand side here, or on the left-hand side of the screen, is baseline of the right lung of this patient who was a participant in NLST. This is a 69-year-old man with a very heavy tobacco history, and the baseline screening scan did not show any abnormalities. We're just looking at one slice here, but there were no worrisome nodules throughout the scan, and the radiologist that nothing was suspicious. However, Sybil, the machine learning algorithm, looks at the scan and placed this patient at the 75th risk percentile for future lung cancer. When we asked in retrospect Sybil to tell us where geographically in the lung the concern was or what made the risk so high for the patient, the machine learning sort of highlighted this area, which is shown in red, is not a PET scan. Okay, so this is not an FDG PET scan like we might clinically order. This is an attention map from the Sybil algorithm that told us that this particular region was why they placed the scan in the 75th risk percentile. So this patient came back for their next scan as part of the NLST trial, and there was a worrisome nodule that had appeared pretty rapidly in this area. This patient did go on to have surgery, had a stage one lung cancer resected. So this was a win in terms of the NLST trial. This was a screen detected stage one lung cancer. But I think what's interesting is in the real world, the majority of patients after a negative baseline scan do not come back, unfortunately, for more screening. And so in the real world, this patient probably wouldn't have been missed. It would have presented 2 or 3 years later with stage four lung cancer. So you can imagine that a tool like Sybil might be able to really say this patient really needs to be followed closely because the risk is high, in the future. And this is a very interesting paper from Gerard Sebastri that talks about the real world outcomes of the first 1 million patients that underwent lung cancer screening in the U.S., how many cancers were found, what stages they were, both of which support the idea of stage shift and early detection. But I think one of the discouraging things this paper showed was that the adherence was very poor. Only 24% of people who got one annual low-dose CT ever came back for more. So we have to do better as we implement screening, and maybe a tool like Sybil could be one way. In fact, my hope is that a Sybil or another tool like this that could help us determine personalized risk completely independent of smoking history could be a way to think about population-based screening where everybody at a certain age, maybe it's 50, but everybody gets a CAT scan as a baseline and has a risk prediction applied to it so that we can really tell which patients need frequent scanning. Like maybe that example I just showed would be the top patient here, where the risk at baseline is high and they need frequent scans to be able to detect lung cancer. Whereas maybe another patient might have a very low risk and wouldn't need to come back for another 10 years. This sounds, so far away from where we are now, but this is how we do colon cancer screening. This is how we do cervical cancer screening. We do a pap smear and we also test for HPV. Depending on that risk prediction, we know HPV is really the mechanism by which cervical cancer starts. So if you're negative for HPV, you don't need another pap smear for 5 years. And same with colon cancer, everybody gets that baseline colonoscopy. And depending on if there are polyps, we then modulate how frequently to do the next one. Other technologies, there's a wealth of technologies coming up to improve future lung cancer screening, and we only have time here to touch on a couple. But the other one that I'll mention is this blood-based assay, which is looking at circulating tumor DNA at fragmentomics. So the idea here is that when DNA is shed into the blood, enzymes clip it up into little fragments. And in a situation where there's no cancer, you can see on the top line how these fragments over the whole 26 different chromosomes are essentially very heterogeneous, very homogeneous in size. When you have lung cancer or another type of cancer, these fragments of DNA become very varied. Some are tiny, some are very long. And so you see the amplitude of these different fragment sizes start to go haywire when there's cancer. And so based on lab work that came out of Johns Hopkins, this company is basically developed a blood-based assay with the intended use of testing it in patients who qualify for lung cancer screening but have not yet gone for that CAT scan. And there can be many reasons, as we talked about in a prior module, Maybe it's over an hour drive for them to get there. Maybe that provider didn't order it for them. But if you get this blood test, it's essentially looking for signs of cancer that might be already in the lung, just not known about. And the assay is designed to basically accept false positives with the goal of not missing any cancers. And so what that translates into in this first clinical trial that was very recently presented at the CHEST meeting this year is that if this blood score is elevated, then it really pushes you to get that CAT scan. So if you have an elevated score on the blood test, the number needed to screen to diagnose one cancer is only 84. We talked about just the all-comer number needed to screen was about 300. And so this may be a way to help risk stratify patients as well, to really see who needs to urgently be screened. What are your thoughts about these kind of tools, Dr. Nadasinghe?
Yeah, I mean, I think these are fantastic. I think they're really exciting, and it's an indication of how the field is changing so quickly. I think one of the million-dollar questions in much of this is how do you get these types of technologies into the communities that are most impacted by lung cancer and are most impacted in terms of lung cancer mortality? And I'm particularly intrigued by the AI approach. I think it's certainly AI is here to stay, and we'll see more and more AI used or integrated into clinical practice. You know, I wonder if something like that might be might serve to complement a reading in environments where perhaps you don't necessarily have a thoracic radiologist who is familiar with lung RADS scoring, for example. Can this be something that runs in the background and serves as maybe an additional check? Because it's known that thoracic radiologists are in short supply, right? And I think whenever we have someone who is very familiar with lung RADS scoring and identifying all incidental findings among a radiologist, we hold on to them, right? Because they're so valuable. They're hard to come by. I think the same could be said for blood-based testing. It is clearly exciting, and it has the potential to shift the way in which we screen individuals and determine risk. It maybe also minimize what can sometimes feel like a log jam and people are trying to get a CT scan, particularly when they're in low-resourced areas. Can a blood test help in that, you know, help in that regard? It does require people to think differently, though. And so it's the reason why these types of technologies really need to get into that clinical utility phase, particularly in communities, and see what the uptake really is.
Yeah, absolutely. I think this future is going to have a lot of creative and exciting ideas. So a lot to look forward to. In Module 4, we're going to talk about leveraging screening and early diagnosis to make the most of the latest treatment advances in lung cancer. And we'll highlight some of the recent treatment and therapy approaches that have really come to bear in lung cancer. And I think, to be honest, this is really why screening is important, because the ability to cure early stage lung cancer is increasing. And so we really want to identify patients who have early stage lung cancer so that they can take advantage of the greater chances for cure. When we think about the three main types of providers that care for early stage surgical patients, we've got thoracic surgeons, we've got radiation oncologists, and we've got medical oncologists. And I would say there have been massive advances in all of these three fields that are leading to better survival for lung cancer patients. In surgery, we've gone from open thoracotomy as the preferred way for removing a section of the lung to VATS, video-assisted thoracoscopic surgery, which is, you know, similar to laparoscopy. You've got small incisions and you're using a camera instead of a large incision that is harder for patients to recover from and really disrupts the mechanical the way that their breathing works mechanically when they have a thoracotomy for the rest of their life in the future. So that has been a huge improvement. And now in the last few years, many centers are getting robotic assisted surgery, which is giving even sharper clarity and better ability to manipulate those tools through the VATS incisions. We saw a big randomized trial recently suggesting that smaller lung cancer surgeries, less than lobectomies, either wedges or segmentectomies, can provide equivalent survival to the larger old-fashioned lobectomies, at least for peripheral adenocarcinomas of the lung. And so all of these advances are pushing surgery to be easier on patients and lead to better quality of life post-cancer. In radiation oncology, we've also seen advances in the types of planning and precision that can be delivered through the more modern radiation machines so that there's less incidence of pneumonitis, less long-term complications for other organs in the chest, and really more focused stereotactic radiation that really gets to the meat of the tumor. In the field of medical oncology, really it's a whole different world than it used to be when we think about treatments that can be given for early stage. When I started my career, the prevailing sentiment was that there was no chemotherapy that could be helped in early stage disease, that it only hurt people. And then in 2004, adjuvant chemotherapy was first proven. But the drugs have changed so much, and the improvements are so dramatically different with modern regimens. I would say two different types of treatments that have really changed early stage medical treatment is targeted therapeutics and immunotherapy. So targeted therapies are based on the genetics of the cancer itself, where there are some lung cancers that are driven, molecularly driven by a specific gene. And we now have therapies that can shut down the signaling from that gene protein. And so if you know that a resected lung cancer has a specific driver mutation, for example, EGFR and ALK are the two driver mutations that now have adjuvant therapies, we can now give a targeted therapy that comes in an oral pill form for a couple of years after surgery that markedly decreases the chance of recurrence by killing any cells, any micrometastatic cells that, you know, somehow survive the surgery. Only a limited number of patients have these specific targeted genes in the cancer. So what's made an even bigger impact is the advent of immunotherapy. Immunotherapies are drugs that were first given for advanced cancer, but are now moving into the perioperative space that basically help one's own immune system recognize that those cancer cells are foreign and are not supposed to be there. And it unmasks or uncamouflages the cancer cells so that our immune system can go in and destroy the cells. And what's really interesting about immune therapy is that just like a vaccine, it imparts a memory onto our own immune system. So it's not just active while you're getting the medication, but we think that it actually teaches your immune system how to recognize those cancer cells. And that could be even years in the future when you're no longer receiving the medication itself. And over the last 2 years, we've seen an explosion of FDA approvals of immune therapy in early stage lung cancer. So first it was for just after surgery as an adjuvant treatment. And now in the last year or two, we've seen multiple approvals for neoadjuvant treatment, which means before surgery. So before the surgery is even done, patients are getting some chemo and immunotherapy. Then the surgery is done. And what we're seeing in those trials is that a decent portion of patients have their tumor majorly shrunk down or even completely resolved just by those treatments alone. And then immune therapy is sometimes continued after surgery for a year to really get that immune system to recognize cancer cells and to keep the cancer in check for the future. We're seeing that this has had a major impact on survival of early stage lung cancer. Though, and think this was, a very quick overview for the non-oncology audience, but the whole point, I hope I've been able to give you some information about how the state of lung cancer treatment has really changed. So Dr. Madison-Singham, I wonder what your impression has been as a pulmonologist and what your patients, as well as your colleagues, talk about or think about lung cancer, how that's changed now compared to when you started in your career.
So I remember a time when people really looked at lung cancer through a very nihilistic lens. And what we've seen over the last 20 years is that the narrative has changed. Now we really do talk about patients living with their lung cancer as opposed to dying with their lung cancer. The reality is that there's so many more options now than or maybe 20 years ago. And there's every reason for patients and their physicians and family members to be hopeful when a loved one is diagnosed with lung cancer. I think the other thing that I would say is that this is really a prime example of basic preclinical science working with the clinical medicine and the fact that so many amazing discoveries over the last 20 years have actually made it to the clinic. And that's what we're really seeing. And there's every bit of reason to believe that this will continue to happen as we move forward. So I'm very, very hopeful for the future for lung cancer early diagnosis as well as treatment. And I think our patients and our colleagues should be as well.
I agree. It really drives home the fact that we need to screen people and find as many of the lung cancers as we can at the earliest possible stage. So thank you all for joining us for this activity today.
This activity is certified by PVI, Peerview Institute for Medical Education. This activity is developed with our educational partner, Longevity Foundation. After completing the modules, remember to download the slides and practice aids. Thank you for listening. Download materials and complete the post-test for instant credit at peerview.com/PJP860. This activity is supported by an educational grant from Merck & Company, Incorporated.